Hello there, welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm a former Director of Public Prosecutions, a barrister practicing from Matrix Chambers, and a crossbench member of the House of Lords.
And with me, Tim Owen. I'm also a barrister at Matrix Chambers, specialising in public law, crime, and human rights law.
This week, Tim and I are going to discuss the vexed question of judicial power, what its proper limits should be, how far it should go. And we have with us the ideal guest to discuss these issues, and that's Professor Richard Eakins, who's a tutorial fellow in law at St. John's College, Oxford, and also Professor of Law and Constitutional Government in the University of Oxford. Richard was born and brought up in New Zealand. He did his undergraduate degrees, and I stress degrees, at the University of Auckland before coming to Oxford to read for a Bachelor in Civil Law, an MPhil, and finally a DPhil. He was a lecturer in law at Balliol College, then returned to New Zealand and was a judge's clerk in the High Court of New Zealand before becoming a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland, returning to Oxford to his tutorial post at St. John's College. And perhaps most significantly and importantly and relevantly for this podcast, he leads the Policy Exchange Judicial Power Project, which we're going to discuss, I think, probably in some detail during the course of this podcast. So, Richard, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you for having me on.
Hi, Richard. Very, very glad to have you here.
Richard, we normally start by asking our guests a little bit about their background, why they chose the law as a career and why they chose the particular career within law that they selected. So could you tell us a little bit about your background in New Zealand, your childhood, your university days, and why law, if that's not all too much to take on?
Sure. See how far back you want to go. So I grew up on the outskirts of Auckland, went to a small Christian school and then a large comprehensive for my secondary education. I was interested in history and politics in a sort of general and imprecise sense. When I went to university, I thought I would study law alongside something else, which was the norm in Australasia. And really, the study of law for me at that point, as for many others, was a sort of hedge against unemployment in due course. So I studied history and ancient history, and then eventually political science for my conjoint degree at the same time as my law degree. But like many others, I got interested in the law as it went along, and in particular in criminal law and constitutional law, but in particular, even more so, in legal philosophy. I worked for 2 years as a judge's clerk at the High Court of New Zealand in Auckland, doing legal research for a number of judges before coming across to Oxford.
I've watched, in preparing for this episode, Richard, I've watched a number of videos, watched you giving evidence.
Oh, good grief.
Watched to the House of Commons Constitutional Committee, your McGill lecture, and so on. And you say you worked as a judge's clerk. I mean, obviously, you enjoy public speaking and advocacy, and we're going to come on to the work of the political power, of the Judicial Power Project. But did you ever think about being a practitioner, an advocate, as opposed to an academic?
Yes, I certainly did. And I wouldn't say I do enjoy public speaking, actually. I think it's a requirement of the job, I do it and try to do it as well as one can within the constraints. But no, I certainly thought about legal practice, properly so-called. I was contemplating becoming a prosecutor once I'd undertaken study in Oxford, or possibly a government lawyer in Wellington, working for the Crown Law Office or policy advice in the Ministry of Justice. I became more and more interested in legal philosophy. And when I came to Oxford, I stayed around and I undertook a doctorate. And at some point, one makes oneself relatively unemployable as a practitioner, I think. And I was loving the academic pursuit, so I was perfectly happy not to be in legal practice, really.
Well, some people combine the two, of course. We have some members of Matrix Chambers who are both academics and practitioners. But what was the subject of your doctorate in Oxford?
So it was published later as a book, and it's pretty similar. It was a study of the idea of legislative intent. So I began with a grand plan to resolve all the problems of statutory interpretation, and I ended up writing at length on a sort of preliminary problem, although I thought a fascinating one, and obviously one that has attracted an intelligent attention for a long time. So I was defending the idea that it's possible for multi-member legislative assemblies to form and act on intentions. So the long tradition in the common law and elsewhere of talking about legislative intent is not misconceived and premised on a kind of category error, as many distinguished legal philosophers had been arguing with many distinguished judges like the late Justice Scalia adopting the argument.
Tim and I met Antonin Scalia at the American Embassy, actually, and quite a fearsome character. He's one of these guys who was quite squat and had a neck that was about as broad as his shoulders.
Yeah, he was a force of nature, that's true.
We had an entertaining conversation with him. Was your doctoral supervisor John Finnis?
He was.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, John Finnis is a hugely eminent conservative legal philosopher and emeritus professor at Oxford. And as well as you, his doctoral students have included Neil Gorsuch, the conservative associate justice of the United States Supreme Court, appointed by Donald Trump 5 or 6 years ago.
We may touch on him later. In fact, let's touch on him now, because I think it'd be good to start off with the judicial power project. And I think that you and I think John Finnis was somewhat involved, if not practically, as an intellectual influence on the setting up of the JPP. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was that led to the setting up of the Judicial Power Project and what it's intended to achieve?
Sure. I mean, and John Finnis is a major intellectual influence on me, and I've benefited from his wisdom and advice on all manner of things across my doctorate and thereafter. And I did speak to him after I decided with Policy Exchange to set up the project. And he gave a barnstorming lecture in October 2015, which we may touch on. We decided, so I was approached by Policy Exchange very end of 2014 to see if I was interested in doing something on the courts and the Constitution. And I was, because I'd been thinking a lot about this across the course of my academic career. Many of my articles from my first short article in 2001 onwards had been on this subject in relation to New Zealand and the United Kingdom, and just in general, in fact. And so I gave this some thought, and in early 2015, we proceeded to launch, so to speak, the Judicial Power Project, which had as its, it still does, as its ambition, study and public commentary on the constitutional balance, in particular the role of the courts in the Constitution, and a defence of the traditional understanding, as we saw it, as I see it, of the role of courts as being vital but vitally limited, not standing in judgment over Parliament, able certainly to correct executive unlawfulness, but exercising self-restraint so as not to to take over the practice of government. So it was viewed as, and still viewed by me and those others who've given me a great deal of help along the way, certainly not a one-man band, as a defence of the political constitution and an account of a limited role for courts, which we think is quite traditional.
It struck me, Richard, reading the lecture, which I remember reading it some years ago, and I reread it again in preparing for this. The structure of the lecture, which was, I think, being delivered in memory or honour of Francis Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon, or at least there was lots of references.
Well, it was in Gray's Inn, so there's lots of references, yes. Yeah.
Lots of references to Bacon, yes, obviously it wasn't the Bacon lecture. But it struck me, I don't know, there were 10 theses that he sets out within the lecture, and some of them are easier to follow for a mere practitioner such as me than others. And it did strike me, particularly then reading your subsequent document, Protecting the Constitution, which was published in 2019, there is a sort of direct line between the Finnis 10 theses and your philosophy. But it did strike me that it's quite a sort of ideological set of beliefs. And I mean, you apply it then across the board to all the recent developments in what you regard as the development of an impermissible degree of judicial power, which is contrary to your vision of the rule of law and particularly parliamentary sovereignty. I mean, it did strike me that he finishes a sort of Ignatius Loyola or Karl Marx or Mao Zedong of the Judicial Power Project. Anyway,
I think Tim's question encapsulates a broader question, which is a criticism that's sometimes been made of the Judicial Power Project, that it's actually a political project as much as a legal philosophical project. In other words, you're coming from a political ideology, which is familiar also in the United States, in some sections of the Republican Party. And although it is dressed up in legal language, what's really going on here is a political project to rebalance power in the modern democratic state. So I just wonder what your response to that is.
Well, I mean, calling it ideological and saying it's dressed up in legal language, I think are both unfair and their criticisms. So I think I reject them. It's certainly true that there's an ambition to as I said, restore the balance of power within the Constitution. So the aim of the project is to educate several different audiences in public life, partly the public, although to what extent the public reads the John Finnis Gray's Inn lecture, I'm not sure, but also the political classes, parliamentarians and officials across the divide, and the legal classes, of whom, of course, you both and me to some extent are representatives, so the judges, the lawyers, the law students. And probably we've had different levels of success in engaging those different audiences at different times. So John Finnis's lecture, which you may have reread more recently than me, I couldn't list all 10 propositions right now if you asked me to, but I read it with great appreciation on multiple occasions. I helped edit it and so on. And I thought it was a very thoughtful reflection on the history and of the common law tradition and the foundations of a proper judicial role in our constitution. And to that extent, I think it's not ideological. It's a thoughtful exposition of a principled position, which has long roots in our tradition and cross-party roots, I should add.
Yeah.
I thought that it's somehow, and I have heard this line of criticism before, of course, the thought that somehow it's carrying water for the Conservative Party is deeply unfair and just ignorant, I think, not that I'm implying you, either of you are ignorant, but about the history of our Constitution, in which this is scarcely a sort of a recent phenomenon or exclusive to one side of the divide. Clement Attlee would approve, I hope.
Well, I was going to raise that at some point, and since you've raised it now, of course, there is a very long and hallowed tradition of leftist skepticism for judicial power.
I mean, the default position amongst leftist lawyers, leftist thinkers in the 60s, 70s, and even going into the 80s, was that the courts weren't to be trusted, the judges weren't to be trusted, that these were essentially reactionary institutions that had a tendency to block radical measures. I mean, the famous Denning judgment against Ken Livingstone's Fares Fair policy in London in the early 80s, when he tried to subsidise public transport so that fares would be cheaper, was a case in point. I mean, the default leftist position in those days was that the place that would bring progressive change was Parliament. And Parliament was the cockpit of the nation, and the courts and the judges should not be allowed to interfere, or should only be allowed to interfere to a minimal degree, with what Parliament had decided.
I mean, many of us are old enough to remember the famous John Griffiths book, The Politics of the Judiciary, which essentially provided a sort of, I suppose, proto-Marxian analysis of judges and the common law, that these were class-based arrangements to, you know, support the ruling class and to keep those who didn't possess capital in a particular place in the hierarchy. But this was a very long tradition, but it still exists, doesn't it? And there's a whole section on the Judicial Power Project webpage of leftist arguments in favour of restraining judicial power. Could you say something about that?
Yes, no, certainly. Well, I mean, we always thought that was the case, that this didn't come out of nowhere. We had, in making these arguments in the modern age, there was a long tradition on, or traditions plural, that were concerned about the scope of judicial power. And we have published a collection of essays that articulates this from a variety of sort of self-avowedly left-leaning positions, and then commentary on it from those who agree and disagree on the sort of the internal politics of the left. So we were concerned to try to encourage the articulation of a range of points of view that share similar concerns, with I think some success. And relatedly, I mean, from time to time, when we publish a major paper, it'll be endorsed by some member of the great and good, many of whom I think have been on the left, so to speak, or no politics whatsoever.
So as an example of this, you published a paper written by Chris Bickerton, who's a reader in modern European politics at Cambridge. I just want to read something that he said. in this paper. What lies behind the left's growing acceptance of judicial power is a broadening pessimism about using the instruments of politics for significant and lasting social change. This is odd, not least because historically speaking, and most strikingly in the British case, progressive social change has come principally through Parliament and through political struggles, and only occasionally through the courts. An acceptance of constitutional rules was more readily found in the continental European left, owing to different legal traditions. But we see here a similar flight from the national to the supranational in search of legal frameworks that can lock in progressive legislation and insulate it from dangers of political reaction at home. This tells us that the left has given democracy up to its opponents, preferring to strike a bargain with judicial powers. However, as E.H. Carr argued, the legal framework always rests upon a political foundation. This foundation is today defined by a commitment to individual rights and to markets. It's far removed from the commitment to social transformation and a transcendence of market society that was once a hallmark of the political left. This is an interesting paradox, isn't it?
So what's the paradox?
Well, it's interesting that the left is if you like, increasingly supportive of a legal order that traditionally was seen by leftists and by leftist philosophers as hostile to progressive causes and progressive movements.
Oh, there's definitely been a shift, I think, over time in terms of the balance of opinion, so to speak. Obviously, as you rightly say, and as our collection demonstrates, I think, it's not as though the old arguments have gone away or that no one adheres to them, but the extent to which they're accepted and adopted as the foundation has shifted. And no, I think there has been. I mean, we've diagnosed this in various ways. There's been a loss of confidence in the political constitution, in national democracy, and a shift in reliance on supranational techniques or in human rights litigation and so on, in place of the dynamics of politics over time. Now, I think it's a mistake, whatever your politics are, really. If you're interested in good government and democratic self-government, then you should have some concern about those trends. Obviously, a lot of room for arguing about precisely how far those trends run, but that there's been a shift in that direction, I think.
Can I ask you, Richard, going back to John Finnis's 2015 lecture, one of the things that is obviously clear from it, and it's clear also in your writings and statements, is a view of the role of the judiciary, which is, to my mind, incredibly narrow and technical. And so Finnis, principle three, hard cases make bad law. Judicial efforts to reform even the common law are often unproductive or counterproductive. The law is an ass is sometimes a consequence of judges thinking their predecessor's law to be an ass. He gives the sort of hoary old example of the hopeless decisions of the House of Lords in Houghton and Smith, Shiv Puri, Anderton and Ryan, which, as far as I was concerned, because all of that took place just before I was called to the bar, were mainly a reflection of the fact there weren't enough criminal lawyers in the House of Lords. Principle four, the problem of exercising judicial power with a view to reforming the law is one of principle. Making law is taking responsibility for the future. Judges are immune from any requirement to answer for their judgments. Judicial law reform, says Finnis, is an incompetent process for introducing substantial legal change. And so there's quite a central theme to the Finnis approach, which is disdainful. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that, of the role of judges, as far as I can see, in even developing the common law. Because, you know, what is the line between a development of the common law that's legitimate and what Finnis is describing, and which you have tacked, as incompetent lawmaking and illegitimate lawmaking? And I want to ask you a bit, after you've answered that one, about the principle of legality.
Sure.
Your view about how that fits in.
No, have to talk about legality. No, so it is committed to a narrow view. It's true, and it is committed to scepticism about the institutional capacity and, to some extent, the legitimacy of the courts as a lawmaking body. Now, clearly, the common law has developed in part by, across a series of cases, per the techniques of the common law. But there are different common law dispositions, so to speak, and some are readier to understand the court simply as another lawmaker, free to reform the law by fiat, as opposed to developing lines of principle and clearing up incoherences and messes and correcting mistakes. So, I mean, in fact, the Digital Power Project hasn't said a great deal about common law development. It's not been a subject on which we have focused. I mean, perhaps partly because a lot of what we've done is concern constitutional law, where it's not quite so directly in play, I guess. Question that later, if you like.
It's quite a fine line, though, isn't there, between what you call constitutional law, and perhaps we'll come on to the two Miller decisions about which you've obviously got very strong views, but it's a fine line.
Oh, everyone in the country has a strong view in the Miller cases, in our world.
Yes, I didn't mean to say you're the only one with a strong view.
A great deal of us didn't talk about anything else for far too long. By all means, it's a fine line, insofar as the merits of some common law case that corrects a mistake or changes the law will turn on the case in question. If you look at John Finnis's vast body of further work, he's been certainly defended cases in which the courts have, as he sees it, corrected very long-standing mistakes. Kleinwort-Benson, Jogi case, various others. So it's not as though the law can't change or that common law judgments can't correct misunderstandings. But you're right, your initial point. This is a narrow view of the role of the court. It's a technical understanding. And that's grounded, I think, on an understanding of the nature of law, the point of law, the advantages and disadvantages of courts as a forum. And the worry about relative irresponsibility, I think, is well grounded, that courts can't take responsibility for certain kinds of legal changes. And if the legal change is grounded on narrow technical craft of developing and lines of argument and so on, that's sharply different from the sorts of lawmaking act that one sees in certain contexts in human rights litigation or elsewhere, I think.
But if the change or the development, whether it's in constitutional law, as you would call it, or day-to-day, if you like, developments in the common law, under our system, Parliament can reverse it the next day. So I don't,
well,
I don't
not,
see...
Not quite the next day, but...
If it was urgent, it would be an
operational challenge. But you're right, obviously Parliament can reverse the changes. I don't think it follows from that the fact of reversal licenses anything the courts do up and until the reversal. I mean, it's a true and important feature of our system.
Well, it's a hugely important democratic safeguard, isn't it?
Oh, indeed. And that's why I'm robustly committed to it. And if, I'm deeply sceptical of attempts to limit that safeguard precisely for those reasons. Whether or not some change in the law, I certainly don't want to imply that I think the common law, the judges are free to change as they see fit. I think there are developments in common law over time that are unobjectionable exercises of legal craft according to the long-standing techniques of common law development. And there are, and this is, my colleagues who are so private lawyers, for example, who are more articulate in explaining this, there are cases where you can see the court adopting the self-understanding. Well, it's common law, isn't it? We made it. We can change it. I think that's a misunderstanding about the nature of the law in question.
Can we just go on to the principle of legality? I've been dying to ask you about this.
Good.
Because, I appeared in quite a lot of the cases in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, in which the principle of legality was developed in a series of decisions from Raymond and Honey onwards. And in Sims and O'Brien, which is a case no doubt that you're very familiar with, and it's another prisoners' rights case in which I was junior to Ed Fitzgerald. And in that case, in which judgment was handed down in 1999, it was all about whether or not the prison rules were ultra vires insofar as they prevented prisoners having contacts with journalists who wanted to publish, or the prisoners wanted published, information to do with miscarriage of justice and whether they were the victim of miscarriage of justice. And in fact, O'Brien was subsequently cleared of the murder charge of which he was convicted. But in that judgment, Lord Hoffman gave what's regarded as the most famous sort of summary of the principle of legality. Let me just read it, because you will know it, but some people won't. And again, bear in mind, he was saying this in June 1999, so the Human Rights Act was not yet in force, but of course it was on the statute book, but hadn't yet come into force in October 2000. And what he said was this: Parliamentary sovereignty means that Parliament can, if it chooses, legislate contrary to fundamental principles of human rights. The Human Rights Act 1998 will not detract from this power. The constraints upon its exercise by Parliament are ultimately political, not legal. But the principle of legality means that Parliament must fairly, squarely confront what it is doing and accept the political cost. Fundamental rights cannot be overridden by general or ambiguous words. This is because there's too great a risk that the full implications of their unqualified meaning may have passed unnoticed in the democratic process. And then this important point, in the absence of express language or necessary implication to the contrary, the courts therefore presume that even the most general words were intended to be subject to the basic right of the rights of the individual. In this way, the courts of the UK, though acknowledging the sovereignty of Parliament, apply principles of constitutionality little different from those which exist in countries where the power of the legislature is expressly limited by a constitutional document. He then goes on to explain the changes that the Human Rights Act will make. But the point he was making was that the principle of legality was effectively a common law principle of statutory construction to protect fundamental rights in the absence of express legislative intent. Now that, you know, there's nothing to do with the Human Rights Act, nothing to do with the ECHR. Do you have a problem with that as a principle of statutory construction?
You're quite right, it has nothing to do with the ECHR or human rights, although the context of human rights law, the context of the Human Rights Act coming to force is significant, as you've alluded to. I think the principle of legality is sound in its place, but is subject to overstatement and distortion. And the Sims, you gave us the ringing statement of principle from Sims, endlessly quoted.
Yeah.
There's a parallel case, as you know, of Pearson,
which I was also in.
Oh goodness. Okay. Well, you know them all. So Pearson's also often cited alongside. Yeah. Sims, and the statement of principle from Lord Brown Wilkinson in Pearson is a valuable one. I prefer Lord Brown Wilkinson's articulation of the principle. I think it's better. I think it's more careful. I think, Lord Hoffman was an exceedingly good judge, of course. I think the risk in his statement of principle is it implies effectively that the principle of legality is a way of policing Parliament. We're going to raise the political cost, and the implication being we could raise it further if we chose to. And Lord Steyne, I think, in Pearson, his articulation of principle, much less attractive than Lord Pearson's, and has something of this character to it.
I think, to be honest, Richard, I mean, Lord Brown Wilkinson's statement, as far as I've got it here, a power conferred by Parliament in general terms is not to be taken to authorise the doing of acts by the donee of the power, which adversely affect the legal rights of the citizen or the basic principles on which the law of the UK is based, unless the statute conferring the power is clear that such was the intention of Parliament. I mean, it's exactly the same principle.
It's not exactly the same, but I agree with Lord Brown Wilkinson's articulation. It's pretty similar, I'll grant you, but the shift in articulation matters, and the focus on raising the political cost or on making Parliament pay the political cost is a different ground. Lord Brown Wilkinson's ground is much more, we presume Parliament doesn't legislate in a vacuum, and so we presume that existing legal arrangements are preserved unless they're qualified. And I think that is the ground that explains the pre-Sims and Pearson cases. And Pearson, you'll recall, basically has no ratio.
There's no ratio.
Yeah, there's a decision, but no ratio. Sims itself, I think, is, well, they're all arguable cases, but is not such a clear-cut case of a justified application of the principle of legality as the cases that come before. Where I think it was a clearer legal relationship or legal arrangement in the pre-Sims cases, where in Sims, I don't think there was. So it's a less clear-cut application. But Sims and Pearson and so on, I think, are a long way away from some of the cases that come later, which is my concern, where I think the principle of legality has been put to improper uses, like the Evans case, Privacy International.
This principle, it seems to me, has particular purchase when it comes to the protection of minority rights. And there's a lot of discussion, isn't there, about the protection of minority rights in a parliamentary democracy when the majority might pass laws which are destructive of minority rights. And in one of your papers, I'm sorry, I can't remember which one, Richard, you address, I've read quite a few of them to prepare for this podcast, with great pleasure, I might add. In one of your papers, you address this issue, and I think you say a number of things which I think are quite interesting, which from my perspective as a member of Parliament seem to place a great deal of faith in parliamentary debate and decision making. I mean, you say at one point, this is obviously right, that some of the arguments to the effect that it's the judge's role to protect minority rights somewhat disrespect the fact that the majority are the majority. This is a majority that was elected into power by a majority of the electorate. So that's a central thing. I think you also argue that it's for the parliamentary process to pursue this interest, the protection of minority rights, through debate, through rational discussion, through the party system, through elections, through the ability of the electorate to discuss these matters themselves and come to a conclusion and elect a different government, which will then, I suppose, respect those rights. But isn't that all a little naive in the current political climate in which we find ourselves, not just here, but in other parts of the world, where, you know, some political movements are increasingly radical, perhaps increasingly dismissive of minority rights? I mean, it's not obvious to me, listening to debates in Parliament, that my fellow parliamentarians are always cognizant or particularly interested in this issue. They have a point of view, they want to win the debate, and when they win the debate, they're very happy about it, and that's the end of the story. Isn't it rather obvious that there needs to be some mechanism outside Parliament which has a role in policing this? I mean, always given that Parliament can deal with a judicial ruling it doesn't like by legislating, I mean, there's always the final power of Parliament to make a decision. But isn't it necessary to have some mechanism that can respond, that can mitigate, that can make less stark, drastic, or damaging the approach of a parliamentary majority when it really does appear to be overriding basic human rights, and particularly the basic human rights of a minority? Can you really rely on the parliamentary process itself to mitigate, to deal with, to resolve these issues to the exclusion of any other institution?
Well, I think, can you rely on the parliamentary process to decide what the law should be, including what rights persons should be entitled to enjoy as a matter of law, what justice requires should be done to each of us? Well, yes, you can. Whether you should is the question. But we certainly, we have relied in our tradition, in New Zealand, where I come from, before the Bill of Rights Act was enacted, and even after that, to a large extent, it's not quite the same measure as the Human Rights Act. We have relied on the parliamentary process to be the way in which we make decisions on point. Knowing, of course, that many of us, maybe a significant minority in each case, will think that the decision that has been made on some controversial matter is wrong, maybe really wrong, and should be reversed as soon as possible. And pressure can be brought to bear in a whole variety of ways. So, I mean, you alluded to the role of the electorate. It's not just the role of the electorate at elections, but the fact that the parliamentary process takes place in public, nested within a wider public conversation. And I do have confidence in the parliamentary process to be an intelligent way of dealing with difficult questions about how we should live with one another. And I've made my contribution, much less than you obviously, Ken, to parliamentary deliberation from the margins. I hope I'm sufficiently cynical, but not excessively cynical. My arguments are routinely rejected and taken to be unpersuasive, and so I do my best to make them more persuasive, and so on. I think that would be my response. I mean, you added the caveat. Of course, Parliament could be able to reverse a decision of a court, but I think the premises of your argument lead to an opposite conclusion, which is that that very caveat is a sort of standing danger to human rights and to justice. And certainly many of my academic colleagues and colleagues in other countries, maybe similar countries, would view accepting that caveat as deeply irresponsible. Now, I don't view it that way. I mean, you can say parliamentary sovereignty is living dangerously in some ways, but it's disciplined by political culture, and in a country that has the relevant social conditions for, you know, turn and turn about in government office, and not abusing a temporary ascendancy to cheat and to cancel elections and so on, then it's not a it's not a rash gambit.
Well, I think we can have our cake and eat it on this one, can't we? Because we can have a system in which judges are entitled to protect basic rights, even in the face of legislation, and a situation in which Parliament, if it wants to, can overturn those judgments. The reality is, in a polity such as ours, if the courts come to those sorts of judgments on reasoned and persuasive grounds, Parliament, although it is entitled to, will rarely step in the way you suggest. So I'm not sure this is a either or. I think we can have a bit of both. And isn't that rather what we have at the moment? And doesn't it work rather well at the moment?
Oh, well, you're certainly right. We should consider the mixed position we have as opposed to alternatives elsewhere, including the alternatives we've had earlier in our constitutional tradition. So I'm not ruling it out by fiat, so to speak. One could certainly say we have the best of all worlds. Hooray for the happy state of affairs we've arrived at. Now,
is that an official statement of the Judicial Power Project?
No, I said you could say that. You could say that. The reason I doubt it, the reason I'm skeptical about it, I mean, I think, you know, if you ask me, am I, in comparative terms, I think we are better off than, for example, Canada or the United States, Canada being a more similar country in constitutional terms. But where there's a nominal capacity of their parliament, or parliaments plural, to respond to judicial decisions, but where in fact it's an atrophied power and the political culture has adopted wholesale a view that really judges are overwhelmingly the paramount body to be deciding these questions. I think very much to their the disadvantage of their constitutional arrangements. I think you can see some terrible consequences arriving from that on particular areas. I mean, you may take a different view, but the way in which assisted suicide has worked out in Canada is straightforwardly a consequence of the perceived superiority of their courts in that in relation to that question. And so, I mean, there's a question of how stable our arrangements are. And clearly they've changed across the 20 plus years, 23 years, I suppose, almost, in which the Human Rights Act has been in force and in which we've been longer members of the European Convention. And this does change over time. And so the question would be, well, where are we going? And is what we have now a sort of happy medium? I think it's getting better in relation to domestic human rights law, precisely because the Supreme Court is being more inclined to view its role as very much residual in a way that wasn't the case a few years ago.
Can I just go back to something in the executive summary of your 2019 paper, Protecting the Constitution, and it relates to what we've just been talking about, because reading it as well as other material things that you've said, it just strikes me that you and I have been living in a parallel universe. Yeah, so the beginning of the executive summary says, the rise of judicial power in the UK in recent years is a striking change in our constitutional arrangements, in how we are governed. A change, this is what you say, that threatens good government, parliamentary democracy and the rule of law. Now, that is a strong opening statement. And then in the paper and other statements that you've made, and I'll come on to your views about the Miller litigation a bit later, but I've been litigating human rights cases in the courts since 1983. And the world that you describe of activist judges developing and going sort of rogue and making law left, right and centre and granting illegitimate victories to litigants based on what you would describe as fundamental departures from constitutional principle, it's just not the world that I've been living in. I mean, I lose most of my cases, Richard. Believe you me.
a shocking admission, Tim.
Oh, he mentioned a few good victories before. You're fine.
I've had some victories, of course, but my experience, and I think you'll find this about most human rights lawyers who are litigating convention cases, you know, you lose probably more than you win.
Sure.
And so you pick in your writings a few cases. You pick the Jackson case, and you focus on what Lord Steyn said in paragraph 102, in which he, as a sort of minority view, holds out the possibility of a nuclear option of the court in the face of a government that wanted to abolish judicial review, a court ignoring primary legislation. But I mean, that's Lord Steyne. It's one person. And you've picked on a number of other cases.
Well, there's Lord Hope too, and Lady Hale to some extent as well. So the same case.
All right.
Lord Hope is at least as strident.
But
as
he's in a minority. They're in a minority.
Sure. No.
And all I'm saying is, you concoct, or not, sorry, I don't, that sounds too pejorative. You describe a vision of hell of these judges having, you know, judicial power having really just run out of control and needing to be reined in. Now, you have just said, which I think a lot of people have commented on, which is the recent changes in appointments to the Supreme Court and Lord Reed's presidency have brought about a change in decision making, one which you welcome and others don't. But I just don't see the world in the same way as you.
Can I add that the experience of criminal lawyers raising human rights and convention arguments before the Court of Appeal Criminal Division has not been an entirely happy one.
Sure. Well, a few things to say about this, I suppose. So, I mean, one important point is I've always taken the view, and I think I've said it publicly on multiple occasions, that there are not all the judges think the same way, very clearly. It's always been the case. And different judges have been more or less enthusiastic about the what I call the new dispensation, although that's probably to suggest it's too categorical. So there have been differences of opinion, and at various times, certain views of the judicial role have been more or less assented. And I don't just mean on the bench, but I think in the wider legal profession, certainly in the academy, and I think these are connected. This is how legal culture is created and maintained over time. Now, I certainly I've noted the various points at which judges have exercised, as I see it, self-discipline and have avoided the temptation that one sees or the problematic technique, perhaps, that one sees in certain lines of case. And whether or not the nature of the criticism to which judges are subject in these cases can be very different, I think. I mean, I was very critical, still am, of the Lord Steyne and Lord Hope dicta in Jackson. I think, you know, you said it was a nuclear option. It should be shocking that judges are openly contemplating striking down acts of Parliament without the authority of some public decision.
Yeah, but that's 17 years ago, and no one has ever, no judge.
Well, Privacy International is 4 years ago.
But I mean, again, a minority view. I mean, the idea that there's a sort of a real danger of our judges overturning or refusing to follow primary legislation, I just don't think it's real.
Well, I don't think judges are likely to do it either. But I think 3 of 7 judges in 2019 committing themselves to this possibility, or at least entertaining this possibility, commitment's too strong, is a striking fact and warrants comment. And I comment on it, and the response is, oh, what are you worrying about? There's nothing to see here. And, you know, if there is nothing to worry about on that point, then hooray, I'm happy. But those dicta are not insignificant. But they're not the main act, by all means. And in a sense, I mean, you both raised, you know, making convention rights arguments. You know, the Human Rights Act is not the judge's fault. Emphatically so. It was enacted by Parliament. It's Parliament's responsibility. Now, you can ask, and I have, hard questions about the way in which judges have received some of the responsibilities conferred upon them and developed the techniques and deployed them in particular cases. But, you know, the central question, should they have this jurisdiction? Well, that's not their choice. They have to exercise it.
As Lord Bingham said to Peter Goldsmith in the Belmarsh case.
Sure.
He pushed back on him, saying, don't tell us that what we're doing here is illegitimate. That's what Parliament has told us to do.
Yes, although there are some criticisms one can make about the Belmarsh case, which are made in the John Finnis lecture. But the central point...
I don't agree with John Finnis on that.
No, for fair enough. The central point is well taken, I think, that there's the separate question, should the courts have this jurisdiction? What responsibilities should they have? And that was a live question for Parliament in 1998, and it's quite properly in our system an ongoing live question. And the fact that you lose most of your cases, so to speak, or at least some cases, we're not speaking about possibilities, it doesn't mean that the existence of this technique isn't significant, that this mode of engaging in challenge to government actions isn't something that one can have concerns about, even if in many cases, maybe even most cases, the judges are careful, responsible, and don't get carried away with the technique.
So, Richard, can we move to the Miller litigation, about which you've expressed very, very strong views, both of them, Miller 1 and Miller 2. So just briefly, Miller 1, the Supreme Court upheld 8-3 the ruling of the 3-0 divisional court, to the effect that the nature of rights created by the European Communities Act 1972 in effect meant that European Union law was constituted as an independent overriding source of domestic law, and that the nature of that reality meant that it required an act of Parliament to be enacted to trigger the process of leaving the EU in the wake of the referendum. That's really what was decided. And so effectively 11 judges held that in the divisional court, and the Supreme Court, with Lord Reid, Lord Carnworth and Lord Hughes dissenting. Now, you have said that about this decision, that it was never for the Supreme Court to manage relationships between Parliament and government and to impose its own prescription for good constitutional practice. You say the courts acted wrongly. They encouraged further political litigation. They supported the opponents of Brexit. You said Parliament didn't need protection from government. The whole premise, you say, of the Supreme Court's ruling was unsound. You said a false narrative was established by political elites, which was then vindicated by the Supreme Court. You said that the decision in Miller 1 led directly to the constitutional crisis, as you call it, in autumn 2019, and Miller 2. In relation to Miller 2, which was a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court that the prorogation of Parliament was unlawful, void and of no effect, you are equally ferocious in your criticism of it. You say it's a remarkable judgment. It makes vivid, you say, the extent to which judges are increasingly willing to abandon settled law in order to compensate for imagined deficiencies in the political constitution. You say it was a rushed, ill-judged lawmaking act. The Supreme Court, you say, simply took sides in a political controversy. It made a bad political crisis into a worse constitutional one. And then you say this: unfortunately, the fact is that government has increasingly good reason to fear that the courts will not faithfully give effect to acts of Parliament, but will distort or undermine them. That political opposition will be played out in the courts. Now, you will well recall the Daily Mail headline after Miller 1 in the divisional court describing the judges as the enemies of the people. I'm bound to put it to you that the tone of your critique of Miller 1 and 2 is pretty inflammatory. It's pretty much saying the Daily Mail is right. These characters are the enemies of the people. And I suppose that one of the things that occurred to me is if you take Miller 1, when you've got 11 judges, Lord Thomas, Sir Terence Etherington and Philip Sales, Lord Justice Sales as he then was, in the divisional court, and then you've got 8 judges in the Supreme Court, including Lord Sumption, all finding that an act of Parliament needed to be enacted. And Lord Sumption, even though he wasn't in Miller 2, as you know, strongly disagrees with you and thinks that it was a perfectly understandable ruling, not least because the government... Firstly, it's not news to know that the prerogative is judicially reviewable. We've known that since GCHQ in 1984. And the facts of this case were that the government provided absolutely no justification for the prorogation. If they put forward a justification, who knows what the outcome would have been. I suppose I think, do you not sometimes when you're lying in bed at night, sometimes think, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all these judges have got it right.
And just before you answer, because what Lord Sumption said in defending the unanimous ruling in Miller number 2, on the basis of what he described as particularly disgraceful constitutional abuse by the Johnson government, what he said was, if you have a power and you abuse it, you find the system steps in to curtail it. What's wrong with that?
A few questions there. So, let me take a few of them. Do I think sometimes the judges might be right, and the ones I'm disagreeing with, and me wrong? Certainly. And I hope I think about it carefully before I reach the conclusion that they're wrong. And certainly, I never say I think they're wrong unless I really think they are, and I can provide some reasons that I'm willing to stand by. And by all means, the risk of commenting too soon or in failing to give proper credit to a sophisticated argument which one disagrees. But I have, as you'll see from, I mean, you've referred to them, I have given those cases, both those cases, significant thought. And I do agree with the very powerful dissent by Lord Reed, Lord Hughes, and Lord Cartwith, and especially Lord Reed in the first Miller judgment. And I mean, you summarise the arguments in a sense, but I think and I don't know how far we want to go the merits of the case in the time we have left, but the argument that the EU law constituted an independent and overriding source of law, I think was very hard to square with everything else that had been said about the place of EU law within our legal order, including by Parliament in the 2011 European Union Act.
But just sorry to interrupt me there, Richard. I read Lord Reed's dissenting judgment this afternoon, and I mean, it's a very powerful analysis, but it is a legal analysis. He is disagreeing. I mean, there's a warning at the end there about the dangers of judges stepping into the political arena. He does say that right at the end, but his analysis is a very rigorous legal analysis in which he shows why he disagrees. It didn't seem to me...
So is mine, Tim. So is mine.
No, I know it is. That's the point. I suppose my point is this. He wasn't saying that... He wasn't attacking the majority view as somehow a sort of a political departure. It was a disagreement about law and the meaning and the impact of the European Communities Act 1972 and the legal consequences of that act.
But my commentary has never been, and my view is not, and has not been, and is not now, that the majority on of the Supreme Court in Miller number one were opponents of Brexit, so were trying to flout it. And that's the utter absurdity of the Daily Mail, that they thought the judges were going to vote their politics in that crude sort of a way. Do I think, though, that the narrative that was ascendant in legal circles in late 2016, early 2017, did not do some work? Well, I think it did do some work. I think you can see that in partly the characterization of EU law, but especially in the line, which is significant in the judgment, majority judgment, that this is too important a question for the government alone to decide. And in our tradition, that means Parliament must decide it. I think, and I'm not the only one, distinguished public lawyers, academic lawyers, take the view that that's a groundless proposition. And I don't mean that it's that the judges are sort of deliberately cooking the books or anything. Emphatically not. They are trying to decide the question that is before them. And mercifully, a lot of the political heat had gone out of the controversy by the time we got the Supreme Court, certainly the Supreme Court judgment, as opposed to the divisional court judgment. It was a healthier point. And the dissents really help, I think. They mean people go away from that judgment thinking, well, at least the arguments had a fair hearing, which is demonstrably true. Now, I've criticized the Miller judgments, pointing out where I think they're wrong. I've also criticized, though, the narrative in which they are nested, which is the way in which academic lawyers, practicing lawyers, commentators have talked about what was going on. This may be our parallel universe problem again. what was going on? And the significance of the judgment, as though this was a sort of resounding victory. It was for parliamentary rights and meant that we ended up with all the procedural protections for Parliament that we did. I don't think it's true. You end up with the sort of resolution in the House of Commons at the end of 2016 manifesting itself in a sort of one-line Act of Parliament that says, proceed, Theresa May. So its significance overall in the Brexit process is highly muted, but I think it was unhealthy for our legal culture.
Well, yeah, but I suppose my point is, Richard, that you fasten on those decisions. The way you've just described it now, I think, or your approach to it, I think is slightly different from the way you express yourself in your Protecting the Constitution paper, in which you are really ringing alarm bells that these decisions mark a very dangerous destabilization of our entire constitutional arrangement.
Sure. Well, we haven't spoken about Miller 2 yet.
No, but I mean, I think you know what I'm really saying. I think that you're exaggerating the significance or the impact or the danger of these, as far as I can see, quite conventional decisions.
So I radically disagree that they're conventional decisions. Now, I don't mean that the judges aren't engaged with legal reasons or doing their best to adjudicate the case before. Of course not. But I think that the choices, the decisions that have been made in both those cases, especially in the second, which we'll come on to maybe in just a moment, do involve legal reasoning and an approach to high profile, clearly as they were, constitutional controversies that is incompatible with long settled constitutional law and does encourage politicization of litigation and an undermining of the techniques of the political constitution, which the law has otherwise been pretty careful to protect. And Miller number two, I think, is a worse decision for what it's worth than Miller number one. I think it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard to square with an appeal from the divisional court, given that the Supreme Court never explains what the divisional court got wrong in its rejection of the case at first instance in England. And you mentioned GCHQ, but the court doesn't grapple. The Supreme Court judgment doesn't grapple with the reasoning of GCHQ, save to say we're simply doing what we've always done. We're upholding the limited scope of the power. Now, I'm not the only one, including people who are, let's say, much more gentle on the Supreme Court judgment overall, who think that is a conflation that's unsupportable. That just doesn't make sense.
But Richard, what do you say about this? This was a unique situation. If Parliament was prorogued as was intended for 5 weeks, we were going to crash out of the EU with no deal, and that was the aim.
No, we won't.
Well. That was the risk. That was the concern, and that this was a minority government. It could not command a majority of the House of Commons on this issue, anything to do with Brexit. But you know, that's why we had a general election in December, which settled it. But at that stage, it was a bit like the 2008 crisis in Canada, where the Harper government knew it was going to lose a vote of confidence because its coalition had fallen apart. And Stephen Harper went to see the Governor General to prorogue Parliament so that he could avoid having a vote of no confidence. Now, I mean, the gap in authority and accountability that was going to be created by proroguing Parliament in 2019 was a unique factor, and I don't see personally, I know you and I would disagree about this, that it was so outrageous. I mean, you can argue about Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, and did they get around that by saying, oh, it wasn't a proceeding in Parliament? Okay, maybe. The failure or the lack of accountability at a crucial time, if you like, in the state of the nation, did not, it seem to me, be such an extraordinary thing, therefore, for the courts to intervene?
Well, I don't buy that analysis, I'm afraid, as you might expect.
I know.
But maybe it brings us back to Lord Sumption's defence of the Supreme Court judgment. Now, I prefer Lord Sumption's view before the Supreme Court gave its judgment, when he was in favour of the Divisional Court's judgment. And he and I gave evidence in the same panel to the relevant Select Committee of the House of Commons, and so I'm fully aware that he was in favour of the eventual resolution. But I'm afraid his defence of the eventual resolution is very much a defence of action that can't be supported by existing law. And I mean, you articulated it. You know, if you act badly, we'll change the law and get you. And I think that's not the right disposition on the part of our apex appellate court, including in moments of high political temper and constitutional controversy, where we should be entitled, and both parties, so to speak, or multiple parties to a political controversy, should be entitled to expect the law to be upheld. Now, it's not quite the same case. I don't want to debate the merits of late 2019, but it wasn't a case where confidence had been withdrawn or was about to be withdrawn, and prorogation was a technique to evade that. Now, I think that would have been unconstitutional to try and use prorogation to that end. I still don't think it would have been within the power of the court to be the one to police the breach of constitutional convention in that sense. But that wasn't what happened.
Well, the problem is we don't know what the justification was, because the Prime Minister put forward no justification whatsoever.
He put forward no justification to the courts.
Yeah.
It's true.
Hmm.
He was resting on the entitlement of of the Crown to prorogue Parliament without that being subject to judicial control. Which was the long-standing settled position that's shrugged off by the courts taking the view that the political and practical constraints and the legal constraints, which didn't impugn the prorogation in question, were just not up to it. So we're going to make some new ones up in the heat of controversy. And there was a period, just demonstrably, when the House of Commons could have withdrawn confidence. And they did not. We had a sort of zombie period of government.
Yeah, they didn't want a general election. Sorry, Ken.
No, indeed.
Yeah, I'm only interrupting to say I sense there's going to be no meeting of minds. And... if you've got a few more minutes, I'd like to raise an entirely different topic with you, because it's one that concerns me. It's the question of assisted suicide. As you'll know, under the Suicide Act of 1961, it's an offence to assist in a suicide, and the maximum sentence is 14 years. So this is a serious offence. I mean, the only sentence up from 14 years is life. So Parliament in 61, and this has never been repealed or amended, regarded assisting in a suicide as a very grave offence. Now, when I was DPP, there were, I think, 98 instances of friends, family members taking loved ones to Dignitas, to the Dignitas clinic in Geneva, so that they could be euthanized, I guess is the best way of...
Assisted in their suicide.
Assisted in their suicide, yeah. We didn't prosecute any of those cases. Sometimes we didn't prosecute them because the body in Switzerland was cremated and there was no reliable evidence as to cause of death. But often the body was returned to the United Kingdom and the post-mortem showed massive barbiturate poisoning. And in some cases, those who'd been involved in assisting this suicide, the family, relatives, loved ones, were perfectly open and wanted to be perfectly open about what we'd done. Now, those of our listeners who don't know this, there's a two-stage test for prosecution under our system. First of all, the prosecutor has to be satisfied that there's a realistic prospect of conviction, which simply means a conviction is more likely than not on the evidence. And in the cases where we had the post-mortem or where the relatives have made a confession, we clearly had sufficient evidence. But the second stage test is whether the prosecution would be in the public interest. And in each of these cases, we determined that it wouldn't be. This was at a time when Parliament was resolutely, in both, certainly in the House of Commons, was resolutely declining to render lawful this sort of behaviour. And yet we, by the exercise of our prosecutorial discretion, had effectively, I think, decriminalised a category of offending. In reality, that's what we were doing. We were taking the view that these cases would not be prosecuted. The courts were aware of this, and as you know, and appeared to be relatively content with it. I would say perfectly content with the situation, I guess, relying on the prosecutor's discretion, which is what we were exercising. But it always seemed to me when we were doing this that there was a bit more than discretion, the exercise of a discretion going on. I wonder whether you have any views about the constitutional implications of a situation of that sort.
Plenty of views, yep.
Can you share them with me?
Sure. No. Indeed. So, I mean, prosecutorial discretion is a vital part of the system, of course. And I've talked about this in the context of the Purdy case, which you'll know well, and its successors. The Purdy case involving the challenge to the then DPP, now leader of the opposition, decision not to promulgate a policy in relation to when he would.
Actually, it was originally a challenge to me, but I handed over to him halfway through the case.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I hadn't realised that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I hadn't realised you were involved, Ken, but I thought Sakir.
Well, I remember telling the solicitor on the other side, I bumped into her somewhere, and I said to her, "You're never going to win this case."
Right. Well, I thought the House of Lords, it's the last day of the judgment. The House of Lords was misconceived, and that Sakir Starmer should have been entitled not to promulgate a policy when the point of promulgating was precisely to guide people as to when they were likely to get away with committing a serious criminal offence. So my view is that the court should not have supervised the exercise of discretion the way they did, which was, I think, incompatible with the rule of law, notwithstanding the rhetoric. What you outline, I'm afraid, does worry me in constitutional terms. And you say the courts were content with it, and maybe there's reasons why you know that, but I'd be interested to know what would have happened if there'd been a judicial review challenge. With respect, you were misusing your discretion insofar as you took the view there was no public interest in prosecuting. Now, I'm pretty keen on courts leaving to relevant officials, including prosecutors, the responsibility for determining what's in the public interest. But if the reasoning were, well, Parliament really should have gone on with it and amended the law, I think that's not a ground on which a prosecutor could reasonably decide not to prosecute. I'm not saying that is your ground, but if it were, I think that would have been unlawful. And I think, you know, Parliament, there was a, there's been around the world, but in this country too, an ongoing public campaign to change the law, of course, which routinely bubbles up in Parliament. I'm sure you're receiving letters all the time from people about this issue in the House of Lords. And Parliament had, I mean, maybe it's after your time, but it changed the law to expand its scope, in fact, to bring in online advocacy of assisted suicide, as I understand it. And it rejected calls to liberalise and change the law. So the thought that this is somehow sort of a zone in which Parliament is asleep and therefore something has to give, I think, is misconceived.
Well, in fact, we're hoping to devote a whole episode in the next few weeks to assisted dying, and the law and ethics and morality of it. So watch this space.
I think, Richard, I think, I mean, I was always uneasy about this, and I think particularly for the reason you've identified, which was that at the time we were routinely exercising this discretion in this direction, Parliament was actively considering and declining to legislate. And I think that was a rather stark position. I won't tell you what I think would have happened if we'd been taken to court over this.
No, fair enough.
You raise an interesting point. But I think we better, I mean, we could talk about this for a lot longer, but I think we better end there. It's been a really, really, really interesting discussion. We've taken more of your time than we told you we'd take. So I hope you haven't got some
students we'll
waiting
right,
somewhere in a room.
Very stimulating conversation, thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for joining
us,
Richard.
Yes, thank you, Richard. It was great to get your views. Thank you.
Cheers. Nice to speak with you both. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends, follow us, and if you've really enjoyed it, why not give us a 5-star review on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts, giving us a review. I mean, you can give us a bad review as well, of course, but we prefer a good review. It helps other people to find us. We will be back with you in a week or two. Our producer is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones.